Spiderweb for Two by Elizabeth Enright. Chapter 9. Number 10. Number 8's concealed in number 10. And number 10, though old, is always right. Has traveled half the world and back again. Touched Italy, touched England, and touched France. Carried a load with strength, been known to dance. Unpolished, down to earth, and none too bright. Still, 10 has held his tongue, and with good grace, done all his share, and earned a resting place, with other worthy objects he shall stay, retired with honor, never thrown away. I guess it's a piece of luggage, Randy said. One of those old trunks or suitcases that father and mother took abroad with them. Goodness, I think that's almost too simple. Why would a trunk be known to dance, though? Well, it's sort of far-fetched, but you know the way they jiggle on a truck or maybe on an ocean liner in rough weather. Why would a trunk be called number 10, then? Maybe there's a number on the lock or something. We'll have to see. It was Saturday again, and raining. The first week after vacation had been a busy one at school, and Pearl Cotton had had a birthday party besides. This was really the first chance they had had to start the search. Where do they keep the trunks and stuff anyway? Said Oliver vaguely. Some are in the cellar room, and some are in the storeroom in the stable next to Willie's. Let's start with the cellar, said Oliver. He had a particular fondness for this place, since he had been the first, when they'd moved here, to discover a room down there, full of ancient toys and trophies, belongings of the long-ago children whose father had first owned the house. In fact, it was here that the Melanie trunks were kept. The cellar was a cozy place that cold, wet winter... Let's read that again. The cellar was a cozy place that cold, wet winter day. The big furnace was crackling comfortably, and the grating in its door showed a glimpse of fire like the grin on a jack-o'-lantern. Willie's old stubbed broom and shovel leaned companionably against the wall. The wood was neatly stacked, the coal all tidy in its bin. It was a model of order, and the storeroom beyond it was just as neat. The Melody children hardly ever entered these two places. The suitcases were stacked as neatly as the cord would, and the trunks grouped together under a tarpaulin like circus elephants. Isaac's old carrier stood in one corner beside three electric fans, which were hibernating through the winter. Oliver breathed deeply with a sort of proprietary pride. "This is a good-smelling place," he said. Randy had removed the tarpaulin and was looking at the trunks. Nothing on any trunk said 10, but as they were old and widely traveled, they carried other interesting information. Labels from all over the world, some of them with pictures on them. The Bay of Naples, for instance, done in bright sunset colors, and the Towers of Carcassonne. "I wish we'd ever been taken to those places," said Randy enviously. "Mona's the only one that was, and she was so young that all she remembers is falling out of a high chair in Venice." "Into a canal?" asked Oliver hopefully. "No, silly. Just onto some old floor. Look, here's one from Greece. It's got the Parthenon on it." "It's the names of the boats I go for," said Oliver. "The SS Berengaria, the SS Carinthia, the SS Adriatic. Boy, all I ever was on was the Staten Island ferry boat." "Me too, and a few rowboats, but you can't count those." "Well, I don't understand this number 10 business. The numbers on the locks are all much longer and fancier, but we might as well look into the trunks anyway. You never can tell." But there was no clue in any of the trunks. There was nothing much, just miscellaneous tag ends that had been left behind. Some wads of tissue paper, some wire coat hangers, one brown sock. Oliver found a crumple of newspaper printed in the year 1937, the sporting section, luckily. He sat down to read the old antique baseball scores. "That's not buttering any parsnips," said Randy, using one of Cuffy's pet expressions. "Come on, let's look in the suitcases." "You look in them," said Oliver. "I'm busy. Listen, did you know Mel Ott was playing then? Why, I've heard of him." But Randy, who was ignorant about baseball, was not listening. She had put the tarpaulin back over the elephants and now began to explore the suitcases. In one, she found a penny and a toothbrush. In another, some paper clips and a bead ring that she had made a long time ago. "I wondered what had happened to that," she said. "But now the only finger it would fit was the little one. funny," she thought. "You never think about your fingers growing, too." In the other suitcases, there was nothing to speak of. Dust, stray pieces of Kleenex, a pin or two. Randy sighed. "I guess the stable storeroom's next," she said. Oliver left the yellowed paper with some regret, and they ran up the stairs and out into the rain, first grabbing their raincoats. It was a beastly day, the snow pitted and melting, all the trees howling, and the sky full of scudding, ragged clouds. They were glad to get to the stable and embrace Lorna Doone and give her the sugar lumps they had snatched from the kitchen. The storeroom above was not so cozy as the cellar because it was not heated. Their breath showed on the air. But since it was higher and drier than the other one, it was used for many things besides luggage. Melody coats and garments hung shrouded in large moth-proof bags like giant bats at rest. The hat boxes were built up in towers. Father's old mountain climbing boots and his trout stream wader stood in pairs beside a stack of letter files and a stirrup pump. There were odds and ends of carpet, which Cuffy was sure would someday come in handy again, and many neatly piled cardboard boxes with mysterious identifications written on them in pencil. Some bedspreads, X wooden sheds, some slipcovers. In the midst of all, with a narrow path around it, stood an island of luggage, suitcases on a foundation of trunks. They went through the suitcases first. No success. And then one of the trunks played a nasty trick on them. It still carried a checkroom tag marked 10, and they were sure that they had found the clue's hiding place. But when they opened the trunk, it revealed nothing but old crib sheets. "Why on earth did she save those?" said Randy. All that remained was one little trunk, small, shabby, with rusted clasps. They lifted the lid and saw that it was filled with old family photographs. "Look, here's one of you in your high chair," said Randy, taking it out. "Man, were you ever fat! You looked like a woodchuck." "And here's one of you with no front teeth, grinning like anything, and no front teeth. Ugh," said Oliver. "Here, let me see. Oh, I remember when that was taken. I was 7 years old, and I lost both teeth in the same week. They gave me a quarter apiece for them, and I felt rich and elderly." "Here's Rush wearing a diaper." "Here's Mona. At least it says it's Mona. She's bald as a doorknob, and Cuffy's holding her up in her arms. Cuffy looks so different. Younger, sort of, and not so fat." Oliver glanced at the photograph. "I like her better the way she is." The clue was forgotten. The cold was forgotten. The children sat on the floor, breathing steamily, utterly absorbed in these different, distant people who had been themselves. A million raindrops drummed on the roof. Music from Willie's radio drummed through the wall. "I remember most of these pictures," Randy said, "but I'd forgotten that I remember them." "Me too," said Oliver. "Gosh, did you really ever have a hat like that?" "I guess so. Isn't it peculiar? Why, look, here's one of Mother. I thought we had them all at home." Oliver took the picture she held out and studied it. A young girl sitting in a rowboat, laughing at some vanished joke. "I never knew her very well," he said. "Oh, Oliver, of course you did, but you were just a baby." "She was pretty, wasn't she?" "Yes, yes, now I can see that she was. But when I knew her, I mean when she was living, I never thought if she was pretty. She was just Mother. The way Father is Father. The way Cuffy is Cuffy. The way any grown-up is that you see all the time and love a lot." "I guess so. Say, who is this guy?" "For heaven's sake, it must be Father." The boy looked very serious. He stood with his arms folded, gazing sternly into the lens of the camera. His broad-brimmed hat was turned up in front, his nose freckled, his knickerbockers were torn at the knee, his high-laced shoes scuffed. His stockings, mind you, said Randy, were badly wrinkled. "He wasn't a very fancy dresser," she said, and someone's written on the back of it, "Martin Melendy, age 11 years, the prodigal returneth." "Well, well, we'd better ask Father about this." She laid the picture aside, and they went on with their family research. pictures of themselves and their parents and grandparents and relatives, known and unknown, pictures of babies galore, babies in bathtubs and sand piles and buggies, on laps and on shoulders and in unknown adult arms. After a while it was too dark to see anymore, and as the storeroom was without electricity, they shut the trunk and went back to the house in the rain. "I don't think it ever was a piece of luggage," Oliver said. "Probably not," Randy said. "All that talk about travel made me think so." "Who ever heard of a trunk dancing?" said Oliver. "Being always right, too. Hey!" He stopped dead. "I bet it's a shoe!" "Maybe. Gee whiz, maybe. Unpolished and down to earth, too, and holding its tongue and all. But who wears size 10 around here? Father? Rush wears 8s, I know, and so does Mark. It couldn't be Cuffy or Mona or us." Willie came slopping along in his slicker. "Hi, Willie, how big are your feet?" was Oliver's greeting. "Size 12, replied Willie amiably. "My feet expected to support a larger man. They outdistanced me. Why?" "We're taking a sort of a foot census," said Randy. "Well, anything to kill time on a bad day," said Willie. Father was in the living room reading. He had built a good fire in the fireplace and turned on the lights. It was warm and cozy there. "What size shoe do you wear, Father?" asked Randy the minute she saw him. 11, said Father. "Oh dear," said Randy. "Heck," said Oliver. "Is there anything wrong about size 11?" asked Father defensively. "After all, I'm not a small man." "No, it's not that. It isn't anything, really. Just something I was thinking of," said Randy, helpfully. She held the picture out to him. "Look what we found. Why does it say that about the prodigal on it?" "Good heavens! I haven't seen that photograph in 30 years or more," said Father. "I was 11 years old and had just climbed a mountain by mistake." "Tell us," demanded Randy, flinging herself down on the rug beside the dogs. Isaac was steaming visibly. He had been out hunting in the rain. Oliver preferred the couch. He sat slumped way down, almost sitting on his neck, a position he considered both comfortable and relaxing. Father lit his pipe, or rather relit it. He seemed to light it as much as he smoked it, and began. "Well, let's see. It was a long time ago, as you can guess. I was spending the summer with my grandparents that year. I forget why. And they'd taken a place at Lake Nemesis for the month of August. A little blue, deep lake with mountains all around it. I'd talked Grandfather into letting me take my dog."
"Hector?" said Oliver.
"No, the one before Hector. Gus, his name was. I don't know why his name was Gus, but it suited him. He was a low-slung, stout, bow-legged dog with one bent ear. I loved him and he loved me. It was a bitter blow to us both when Grandfather refused to let him sleep in my bedroom. He always had at home. He used to lie down among the shoes on my closet floor. He had a good friendly way of snoring, and when he woke up to scratch himself, the floor would shake. I missed all that, but my grandfather was unyielding. He did not approve of dogs in bedrooms. Gus didn't like it any better than I did. Sometimes I could hear him give a long, dismal howl of loneliness and boredom in the kitchen downstairs. I could hardly stand it. Grandfather could hardly stand it either. He took to shutting Gus out in a little woodshed back of the cottage every night. My grandmother was understanding, though. 'Never you mind, Martin,' she'd say. 'I'll just slip out and give him a bone before I go to bed. It'll take his mind off his loneliness.'"
"How horrible of your grandfather!" cried Randy.
"He didn't realize. He was a fine man, and I liked him. He was a little elderly and strict, that was all, and didn't remember much about boys, being at that time the father of 7 grown-up daughters. Well, one night, full moon it was, a big wind sprang up. What woke me was a door banging somewhere. It sounded as if it was outside. My first thought was of Gus, naturally, and when I looked out the window, sure enough, there was the shed door wide open, clapping and banging against the wall. I whistled for Gus, but he didn't come, and I listened for him, too, but could hear nothing, so I got out of bed and ran downstairs and out into the yard. But no Gus. I searched high and low, but never a sign of him. I began to be so miserable and worried and angry that I lost all sense of proportion.
I ran back into the house and upstairs and put on my clothes. Then I ran down again into the kitchen and wrote a note by moonlight and left it on the table. It was a reckless note addressed to my grandfather and informing him that I wasn't coming back till I'd located Gus. "Even though it takes me far afield," I wrote. I remember being proud of the phrase. I meant it at the time and started off defiantly down the road in the windy moonlight, stopping every little while to whistle for Gus. When I reached the end of the road, I kept on going through the woods. The woods ran up the hill, but I thought I'd heard barking up there someplace, and I kept on. "Gus! Oh, Gus!" I was shouting and, I confess it, crying a little. I was so mad at my grandfather and so anxious about my dog. And the going began to get tough, too. Hazel bushes as high as I was, just about, and blackberry brambles that scratched me half to death. The moonlight fell in splotches in the tangle, and the trees roared in the wind overhead. When I stopped to rest, I began to think about how wild and lonely it was up there so late at night, and suddenly nearby there was a queer, terrible voice calling out. Lost, inhuman. I nearly jumped out of my skin. Oliver got up off his neck. "Yipes! What was it?" "It called again," said Father teasingly, "and then again."
"Father, you're overdoing it," said Randy, also sitting up.
So then the thing came flapping out of a tree, big and soft as a shadow. An owl, of course. I'd never been so close to an owl's conversation before, and I didn't care for it.
"Oh, just an owl," said Oliver, slumping down on his neck again.
"Try being surprised by one late some night in unfamiliar territory and see how you like it," said Father. I'd been thoroughly scared, and I decided on a compromise. I decided to go back to the cottage, tear up the note, and wait until daylight to search for Gus. But that was easier said than done. I started down the hill in the direction I'd come from, or so I thought, but I must have been royally turned around, because after I'd gone downhill for a while, instead of coming to the road, I found myself going uphill again. I don't know where I was. I didn't know where I was. I didn't know what to do. I just kept plowing ahead, up and up, figuring that when I came to a clearing, I'd be able to see where I was, get my bearings. I wasn't calling for Gus anymore, either. I didn't care for the lonesome sound of my own voice. How that hill went up! After I'd been climbing for a lifetime, so it seemed, it even stopped being a hill and turned into a limestone cliff. And I climbed that, too. I don't know how. And still I couldn't see where I was, the trees were so tall. Up and up and up I went, and the wind died away, and the sky commenced to lighten, and then I came to the top of the cliff and plowed through another tangle, and suddenly found myself out in the open on a rough, tilted, grassy field, and every rooster in the county was crowing. I could see for miles. The sun was just showing the tip of its crown over the horizon. Far away below, and to the right of me, lay the valley I had come from, with its toy houses and churches and little toy lake. Tiny cows were filing out of barns on their way to pasture, and my grandparents' cottage, still in shadow as the whole valley was, looked quiet and undisturbed. No distress signals flying, nobody dashing out of the door. Probably they weren't even up yet. Hadn't even guessed that I was gone. I felt a little put out about it, though. Added to that, from where I was, high as I was, I saw a tiny little speck of white moving this way and that way around the house. It could have been a blowing paper or one of the neighbor's leghorn hens, but I knew that it was Gus, come home in his own good time. My feelings were mixed. I was glad to see that Gus was safe and to get my bearings, but still I felt I'd gone to an awful lot of trouble for nothing, and now there was the return journey to be done. Downhill through all the vines and thorns and mean twigs again, to say nothing of the hazards of scrambling and slipping down the sandstone cliff. I'd had very little sleep, of course, and a terrific amount of exercise, and I was dog-tired. By the time I staggered in at the gate, it was full daylight, and I found everyone just as concerned as I'd thought they should be, more so. I was thoroughly ashamed of myself when I saw my grandmother in tears and my grandfather about to set out in search of me. He'd gathered up a couple of the neighbors, too, to help, and there was Gus, wagging his tail in an ordinary sort of way, just as if nothing had happened. I was a sight to behold, as you can see by the photograph, torn and dirty. "Where in the world did you get to?" they cried. When I described the high hill and pointed to it, it turned out that I had climbed Mount Alfred, the highest hill around there, a mountain really, without even knowing it, and it was considered a difficult climb. "Climbed it by mistake," one of the neighbors kept saying. "Climbed it by accident in the night time. That's rich. That certainly is rich." And he made me wait while he went and got his camera, and then took this picture of me, just as I was, all stuck with cockleburrs and stick tights. Later it was published in the local paper with a piece about me. What had been a piece of reckless foolishness turned out, mostly unjustly, to be glory as far as I was concerned. I didn't deserve it at all. "But what did your grandfather say?" asked Randy. "And what happened about Gus?" asked Oliver. "Grandfather and I arrived at a compromise after that. Gus was allowed to sleep on a mat outside my bedroom door. That was as far as Grandfather would go, but it was far enough. I could hear Gus snoring, and he could hear my voice talking to him if he got lonesome. Then, years later, after Grandfather had died, one of my aunts came across the photograph in his desk with the words about the prodigal written on the back in his handwriting. She sent it to your mother."
"Why didn't you ever tell us this before?" said Randy.
"I thought, of course, I had, but perhaps it was Rush I told, or Mona." "I love hearing about when you were young," said Randy, and for quite a while she forgot about the clue. However, they were no closer to finding it than they had been, and though they went through all the luggage once again, just in case, and then through everybody's shoes, they never saw a sign of it, and weeks went by. In the middle of February, there came a day that should have been the property of April, mild and sunny and still. It smelled like April. Also, by extraordinary luck, it was a Sunday. Father cast a withering glance at his typewriter. "Kids, let's get a lunch together and go exploring."
"Perfect," said Randy joyfully.
"Neat," said Oliver.
"But where are my walking boots?" said Father a little later. "Has anybody seen my walking boots?" he called plaintively over the banister.
"Oh dear, Mr. Melody, did you want them?" cried Cuffy. You asked me to have them repaired, don't you remember? The soles was wore clear through. Oh dear."
"Never mind, I'll wear something else. I have another old pair of climbing boots in the storeroom, but I'm saving those for Rush. I can't wear them anymore. They're only 10s.
"I didn't know grown-ups' feet got bigger," said Oliver.
"Sometimes they do," said Father. "Mine did."
And Cuffy took this opportunity to mention once again that, though she now wore 6s, her wedding slippers had been size 3. For some reason, she was terribly proud of this fact. Randy, however, interrupted her.
"Did you say 10s, Father?"
"10s!" echoed Oliver enthusiastically. "Hurry up, Randy, come on!" As they flew up the stable ladder, Willie, who was currycombing Lorna Doone, inquired where the fire was.
"In an old shoe," replied Oliver over his shoulder.
Willie and Lorna Doone shook their heads at each other, looking remarkably alike. In the old right boot, the clue, of course, was waiting for them.
"It's been here so long it's dusty," said Randy. "Honestly, wouldn't you think we'd have looked in these?"
"Never mind, as long as we found it. What does it say?"
"It's short.
At midnight, when the full moon's bright, 1, 2, 3, and to the right, explore a cave well known to you. Remember cake crumbs. Find the clue."
"We only know one cave that you can really call a cave. It must be that one."
"Yes, and when I was 8, I had my birthday cake there, remember?"
"When's the next full moon, though?"
"Yipes, we just had one. Now we'll have to wait till March."
"Randy! Oliver!" called Father from below. "Are we ever going to get started?"
When they joined him, he said,
"What canaries have you two been eating this time?"
"No canaries, Father dear," said Randy. "This time it's only little crumbs of cake."
End of chapter 9. Read for you by Kara Schallenberg, www.kray.org, on Monday, December 23, 2013, in San Diego, California.